From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the debate over the new Senate healthcare plan and what it means for you. Here's Vice President Mike Pence.
This legislation puts American healthcare back on the path to freedom. More choices, more affordability.
And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The meat of this bill is exactly the same as it was before. And in some ways, they've somehow managed to make it even worse.
Also today, a new fund led by women entrepreneurs focuses on investing in startups with female founders, in part to fight sexism in the tech world.
I had a couple of experiences where the investors would call their wives on speakerphone and have me pitch the business.
Plus,
winter is coming.
All the must-see TV and movies this summer. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. A new version of the Senate healthcare plan is out today. It's the latest effort by Republicans to deliver on their promise to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. This new version of the Senate bill is aimed at winning the votes of both the most moderate and the most conservative members of the Republican Party. It's a bit of a tough sell. This morning, Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas talked about the plan on radio station KFYI.
I think we're making serious progress towards coming together and unifying our conference and getting a bill that can command the support of at least 50 senators and pass into law.
But there is still skepticism among some Republicans. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky spoke at a press conference yesterday and said that the bill does not go far enough in repealing Obamacare.
So when we looked at the bill a week ago and I said, or 2 weeks ago, and I said I couldn't support the bill as it was, they've now taken the bill and made it worse. They've taken any pretense that this is a repeal bill, and they've made it a bill that basically is a spending bill.
And on the more moderate GOP side, Republican Senator Susan Collins from Maine tweeted out today, still deep cuts to Medicaid and Senate bill, will vote no on motion to proceed, ready to work with GOP and Dem colleagues to fix flaws in ACA. On the other side of the aisle, Democrats are also still voicing strong opposition to this bill. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer at a press conference today.
This bill, like the old one, means millions of Americans will lose coverage. The bill was mean when it passed the House. It's mean when it was introduced in the Senate, and it's still mean today.
With so much opposition from both Democrats and even some Republicans, it is unclear if this bill will pass the Senate. In an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network yesterday, President Trump was asked what would happen if the Senate does not succeed at passing this health care plan. Here's Trump's response.
Well, I don't even want to talk about it because I think it would be very bad. I will be very angry about it, and a lot of people will be very upset. But I'm sitting waiting for that bill to come to my desk. I hope that they do it. They've been promising it for years.
Joining me now is Don Berwick. He's the former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He's also a pediatrician and now currently a senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Cambridge. Don Berwick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Osmond. It's nice to be with you.
So, Don, let me begin by getting your reaction to this new health care plan. What stands out to you?
Well, we've only just seen it, but it's old wine in new bottles. That's an insult to wine, I guess. I mean, this is essentially the Senate bill we've seen before with a few tweaks in it. It still has major cuts in Medicaid. I think when it's scored, we'll still see 15 million or more people lose Medicaid coverage over time with this bill. It is still a transfer of wealth to wealthier people. It leans a little heavier on the health savings accounts, savings accounts are tax advantaged, and they only help people who really are paying at the higher rates of taxes. It won't help middle class and lower income people much at all. It really gives states a lot of latitude to dumb down health coverage that removes the requirement for essential health benefits. So, yes, states may seek to have lower premiums, but they'll do that by allowing plans to be offered that are illegal under the Affordable Care Act, plans that don't cover essential services like maternity care or substance abuse care or mental health care. It offers some support for the opioid epidemic, but nowhere near what's needed. It's way short of the amount that needs to go to the opioid epidemic. And a lot of that is happening through Medicaid, which they're going to cut back.
I see.
They lean more heavily on free care pools, but we know, I mean, we've been there, done that. We know free care pools don't get used the way they're intended, and it's inadequate. So this is a disastrous bill for Medicaid populations, for middle-class people who are going to see premiums rise and the benefits fall. So it's not much change from what we saw before.
So that's what I actually wanted to ask you, Dr. Berwick, that this, you know, a bill was introduced with the goal of essentially improving upon that earlier version, hitting at some of the concerns that both the moderate and the conservative wings of the party had. In your mind, does it improve in any way on that earlier version?
I've tried to read it. I didn't have time to read it all. I don't see much change. They're keeping the taxes on wealthier people that are used to support the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, and that is something some Republicans wanted out. So that, in some ways, you could say was maybe a bit of a compromise.
Yeah, although I think it may be a bait and switch. The reason they're doing that almost certainly is because they're later going to show up with a tax bill that's going to offer tax cuts to the wealthy that need to be funded. So instead of having those tax cuts for the wealthy appear in this bill, they've taken that away. But I think you're going to see it reemerge in the subsequent budget bill. That's my tax bills. That's my prediction.
So I would love to talk about some of the specifics within this new bill. It does include a version of a controversial proposal from Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, which would allow insurers to sell these bare-bone policies. These are policies that don't really meet the standards mandated by the Affordable Care Act. And insurers can do this, essentially, as long as they'll agree to offer at least one more comprehensive plan. Can you give us a sense of what kinds of things insurers would be eliminating from plans if they are offering these bare-bone policies?
Sure. Well, first, let's note in Massachusetts, we luckily have some protection here. Chapter 58, the 2006 reform law, would still apply in the Massachusetts, at least as things stand now, if the Senate bill passed. And we have protections in this state that don't allow this to happen. But this change in the bill, it increases the latitude that states have to allow plans to be offered that don't cover essential services. The Affordable Care Act had 10 categories of essential health benefits. You could not have a plan that doesn't cover maternity services or that doesn't cover mental health care. It's not allowed. Now, a state could do that. So under this bill, there will be states in an attempt to control their costs that would allow plans to show up with much worse coverage. That does two bad things. The first is that these are plans worth a lot less than they look. They're cheaper premiums, but you're going to find you're paying much more out of pocket. And if, unfortunately, something happens that is unanticipated, such as a mental illness, you're going to find yourself not covered. So it's really a bad idea. The second thing it does is a little more complicated, which is a low benefit plan attracts people who are very well. They don't expect to be sick, and they'll take their money now. They'll take the lower premium because they don't expect to be sick. They might be wrong, and that's a problem. But the people that stay in are the people who have needs, people who have chronic illnesses or are older. And what happens is you kind of unwind the very basis of insurance itself, and this is the death spiral people talk about. As the premiums go up, well people stay out, or they buy the cheaper policies. Sick people stay in, and those policies go up. So it highly destabilizes insurance, and this especially affects, people, middle-class people who don't happen to have, say, employer coverage. They have their individual and small group market. So it's a destabilizing aspect as well as being bad for one's health.
Okay. So one of the points of sort of logic that I've heard is that by allowing these bare-bone policy plans, it would essentially encourage more young, healthy people to enroll in insurance plans, and then that would then therefore sort of diversify the pool of people. What's your take on that?
To some extent, that may be true, but what the young, healthy people do are going to leave the plans that offer comprehensive coverage and go to the ones that don't. And so the plans with comprehensive coverage unwind to become more, the premiums will go up. Some of the predictions we see for, say, older people, this proposal really hurts people in their late 50s and early 60s before they're on Medicaid. We've seen predicted increases in annual premiums of $12,000, $14,000 for people who are making $50,000 a year and happen to be 61 years of age. So it's essentially destabilizing. The Affordable Care Act has other ways to encourage young, healthy people to stay in. One is, of course, the individual mandate, which is it says you got to be part of the game. But some states like California, for example, have found ways to attract young and healthy people into their plans through marketing and through outreach and through the way they craft their insurance policies. And we could do that. That's fixing the Affordable Care Act in a very constructive way. This isn't.
Okay. I'd love to hear your take on the Medicaid or I guess lack of a change in the Medicaid plans, it looks like, from the earlier version, because you have some experience in that realm. Could you give us a sense of what is happening in terms of changing Medicaid from this open-ended entitlement system? It's going to be now just a system of fixed payments to states. And specifically, would that have an impact here in Massachusetts?
Definitely. Well, Medicaid covers about 70 million people a year. Not the same people all through the year. People come in and out of Medicaid as they lose their job and they get back on their job. That's true in Massachusetts as well. But it's a very big part of our safety net for people who are poor or near poor. About 40% of Medicaid, by the way, goes for nursing home care. It's for people who, it really is a mainstay support for nursing homes for people, which are extremely expensive and unaffordable for a lot of people. There are 1.9 million people in Massachusetts on Medicaid. Half of all people with disabilities are on it. 40% of all kids. It's a very, very important part of the structure. In this bill, it would switch Medicaid funding to a per capita cap. What that basically means is right now, every new person that enrolls, you know, it has a benefit structure. And if it's necessary that more people enroll because there's a recession or more people need it, they can come in. Mm-hmm. And the benefits are guaranteed. Under a per capita cap, that's not true. The amount of money that can be spent on a person is capped. And the way the Senate bill goes, the rate of increase of that cap nowhere near matches the rate of increase of needed healthcare services. So more and more people will drop out. They won't be covered. States can't print money, so they'll have to either decrease eligibility for Medicaid or decrease Medicaid benefits or pay doctors and hospitals less, which will hurt rural hospitals and safety net hospitals more. Governor Baker estimated that the original Senate bill, which is essentially the same as this, would cost Massachusetts over $8.2 billion over 10 years.
Oh, wow, that's here in Massachusetts.
And leave 264,000 residents without coverage by 2025. It would hurt us a lot. And we are not immune to the effect of this bill on people that really need help. And that affects a lot of families, because remember that nursing home coverage. There are middle-class families who know that their elders now depend on nursing homes and that Medicaid's providing the support for that care.
Yeah. All right, that's all the time we've got, Don. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Asma. Thank you.
That's Don Berwick. He's the former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. These days, he's a senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And folks, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Normally on Thursdays, we try to have this weekly Bostonomics segment. Bostonomics is the name of our new biz tech team, and I, in fact, lead that unit. But since I'm here filling in as host today, we decided instead of me talking to myself, we should bring in a couple of outside voices to talk about an issue that has been buzzing in the tech community, and that is sexism. The startup world is known to foster this bro culture that's led to major allegations, not just of gender discrimination, but actual sexual harassment. And some folks say one reason for this is the lack of female leadership. For example, Crunchbase, that's this super useful startup database by TechCrunch, it's found that only 17% of startups in the first quarter of 2017 had female founders. And that percentage has remained flat for the past 5 years. Now, a new fund, led mostly by women entrepreneurs, wants to help change this. It wants to change this by focusing on investing in startups with at least one female founder. The fund is called X Factor Ventures, and it's being launched by Flybridge Capital. It's relatively small by VC standards. Currently, it only has about $3 million on hand, with plans to invest about $100,000 into 30 companies over the next couple of years. We should point out that Flybridge is led mostly by men, and so it's relying on a team of women entrepreneurs to advise the firm on investment choices. One of those women is Anna Palmer. She's co-founder and CEO of Fashion Project, a clothing resale startup, and Wonder Mile, an online platform to browse and buy from retail stores. Anna, first, can you share some of your own experiences? You're someone who's been out in the trenches, trying to get funded. What's it been like as a woman in the startup world?
Sure. So with Fashion Project, we raised about $13 million in venture capital. Through that process, I just went back and looked at my notes the other day. I talked to about 120 investors. And so anytime you talk with that many people, I think you run across really great advocates, but you also have meetings that don't go as well as what you'd like. So the story that I tell where that happened was my very first meeting I had with an angel investor. I was sitting across the table from him, and I think it was a joke now that I know who it is and got to know him a little bit better in the community. But he got to my resume, and I was graduating from Harvard Law at the time, and he looked at it and said, "So you don't have a finance background, you don't have an MBA, what are you, just pretty to look at?" Mm-hmm. And in that moment for me, I know he said it very flippantly, and I think he now meant it as a joke now that I know him. But that moment was pretty defining. I was like, oh, okay. And it just shifted my perspective a little bit going into future meetings.
And I want to bring in a longtime veteran of this industry to get her take on this as well. Rudina Cesari is founder and managing partner at Glasswing Ventures. This is a venture capital firm in Boston. She's also a former partner at Fairhaven Capital Partners in Cambridge and an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School. Rudina, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rudina, you've been listening to what Anna had to say here, and I'd love for you to just begin with your thoughts.
So, what I think is interesting about the dynamics in our industry, both venture, but also how we support, invest, or do not in women-led startups or management teams that have a big component of women and diversity members, is not necessarily the absolute number of 120 meetings or 300 meetings or whatever it takes. Having a lot of venture meetings and finding the right chemistry, the right VCs to back you is par for the course. What I think strikes me, and I'll express it in percentages, is the fact that of all the capital that gets deployed, only 17% is allocated to women. And that is a challenge, and that is a systemic challenge that we have in the industry.
So I have a question for both of you. Even as we've seen sort of a small growth in the percentage of women who are working at VC firms, we haven't really seen a sort of parallel funding increase. And I'd love to understand from you why that's the case.
So in many ways, that's a lack of awareness about what venture capital firms are not investing in. I'm in boardrooms with a lot of men who are just not thinking about, wait a minute, what are we leaving on the table? So the beginning of changing the funding for women entrepreneurs is having more female VCs. It's also investing in an increasing number of tech-enabled businesses like e-commerce, like digital, like the emergence of new consumer platforms where women have taken the lead, and it's a disproportionately higher number of women founders and CEO than, let's say, hard tech. I think as those types of businesses see more funding and as we see more successful entrepreneurs come out of that cadre, we will see both more funding going to women, more awareness with venture capital firms, and eventually some of those entrepreneurs becoming partners within VCs.
I just want to second what Rudina said because I think it's really important. That's what we need. We need more women in that pipeline, more women investing and really moving that needle, not just on a one-off basis, but as an entire group.
So, Rudina, do you feel at all, though, by you having a seat at the table, that it informs maybe the way that you're sort of viewing the situation, even if it's unconsciously? And I ask that in part because I was reading in the Harvard Business Review recently a piece about how male and female entrepreneurs get asked different questions by VCs, and that by asking these different questions, even if it's just a slight difference in language, it actually affects how much funding they get.
Sure, but that, yes, that depends on a number of things. I'll give you an example as to how, and this is very traditional and it has changed a lot, but assume for the sake of argument that you have two teams, one is woman-led, one is men-led, they're pitching, and let's just assume all the other variables are the same in terms of the business idea and execution ability and whatnot. Historically, the men-led team would give you a pitch where it was all going to be sunshine, a $5 million, then a $20 million revenue growth, then a $100 million, then you kind of bought in that vision. The historically typical sort of first-time woman entrepreneur, the pitch would look like, I will generate $3.275 million in year one, $4.52 in year two, and so on. So one party was pitching the vision, and keep in mind that the listening, the audience, all the partners around the table listening to the pitch are also largely men. Big vision, great, he execution chops. And then the next, you know, the woman founder or CEO was pitching numbers that she knew for a fact she could hit. And so that was getting translated as, she doesn't have the big vision, she doesn't have the ability to build a big business. Wrong. It was just, going back to your question around the way language and how it got received and how it got funded, women weren't as familiar with, let me tell you, where I think this could be. And I think you need a bit of both in terms of a pitch and in terms of getting a realistic view, what they can dare to dream and imagine and what they can actually hit.
So Anna, you've been on the other side of that table. You mentioned the two companies that you've worked on, both are sort of in the fashion realm. I imagine that's not an easy pitch at times to some men. I mean, maybe I'm characterizing, you know, men out here too, but but I presume some of them just may not even see some of the economic advantages of the companies that you were pitching. Was that a challenge?
So with Fashion Project, what we really were was a clothing donation platform. Mm-hmm. And the industry that we were going after was actually very metrics driven. And so if you just looked at the numbers of items that were donated, what was out there in the industry, you could make the business case. That being said, though, I think the thing that struck me is the very first conversations where you're just trying to get past the hurdle of, would our target customer use this? I had a couple of experiences where the investors would call their wives on speakerphone and have me pitch the business to them on speakerphone, which I actually
with their
appreciate
wife,
that.
Present. Okay.
Yeah, with their wife. Yeah. Which I actually appreciated that as a founder because I felt like at least they were making the step, even if they didn't emotionally connect with it, they were making the step to find a target customer and show that, you know, they were giving it a fair look. And then their wives would get on the phone and they would react very positively. And then that piqued their interest and we were able to then make the business case for it.
Rudina, you've been in the venture capital business for, is it about 11 years so far in the Boston area?
Yes, it is.
What has your experience been like? I'm curious to hear if you've noticed changes since you first got in the business.
Sure. I mean, it is changing. And I think that should be the point of encouragement, despite the recent news that has emerged. It is changing in that you have a lot more women, including operators and entrepreneurs like Anna, who are now becoming VCs. So we will see the fabric, the makeup of our industry change. We have a long way to go, but the awareness that the change is needed and that the market timing for change is now, that is a fundamental shift and a positive shift. And I do think, and I want to stress the point, that over time, as there are specialized funds like what Anna is doing, I also hope that the real tectonic shift will occur when a lot more firms are doing what I believe Glasswing is doing correctly, which is we integrate women entrepreneurs and as the main part of the pipeline, as much like we do men entrepreneurs, that they get access to the big funds and the real dollars and the real capital, and they are pitching on the other side of the table diverse teams also of women, men, and other backgrounds. Then that's when I think we will really be able to capture the full potential of the diversity of thought and backgrounds.
So, Radina, you mentioned just briefly there, you know, despite some of the problems that we've seen recently. And so I want to just end on that question. You know, we have heard a lot in recent weeks, specifically about sexual harassment in the entrepreneur VC world. I know that, you know, this is not probably unfamiliar news to either one of you, but I'd love to hear from either one of you about what cultural shifts you feel need to happen in order to prevent sexual harassment within this world, within this ecosystem.
First of all, I think what Radina said is right, in that there has been positive change. And even in just the 6 years that I've been in the industry, I've seen a big shift in the conversations that people have been having, just around the table in general. So the number of events that are having panels focused on this, the number of solutions that people have come up with to hopefully change those numbers. I think with the most recent dialogue, it is great because it actually elevated that conversation to a level that it hasn't been before. And so I think we'll see some pretty cosmic shifts.
And are we talking about the accusations of sexual harassment that were reported in the New York Times by women entrepreneurs in California?
Yeah. So the sexual harassment allegations, also just the broader conversation that came out of that of what is women's position in venture? What does this look like with women on both sides of the table? And so I just think because that conversation has now become so public, it's a great time to create some of these solutions and have those cosmic shifts and really create real change and not just talk, which is where we're trying to head with X Factor.
And from my perspective, I think the discussion and the cases, and there have been multiple cases, I think the information broke the story on one particular VC, and then the New York Times broke the story in a couple more. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the cases of sexual harassment are much more the symptom rather than the cause. Mm. I think the underlying cause is the homogeneity topic that we have at this point covered at length. And I think because while there may be bad apples, like in any other market and industry, that misbehave, I think starting with awareness, which we are seeing take place in the market, and then with consequence for one's actions, where if there are VCs that misbehave, there are consequences for their actions, and those consequences are dire, as we have seen from a business perspective. It makes news to talk about sexual harassment, and that's great. But when the news fizzles, if we don't go back to the changing the fundamentals around venture composition, funding more women, funding more diverse management teams, having more independent directors, the symptoms will continue to reoccur and appear, whether they manifest themselves in the form of sexual harassment or something else. So I will leave you with this thought. It is also, the onus also falls upon us as senior women in our industry to help pull up other women, not just by funding them, where funding makes sense. At the end of the day, we are for profit and we want to fund strong entrepreneurs and business builders, but also to help bring other women into the senior ranks within our firms and beyond.
Yeah.
So I think there is an important to-do for us as well as women leaders in the industry to help drive the change.
Great. Well, some parting optimistic words. Thank you, Radina.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Radina Cesari. She's a founder and managing partner at Glasswing Ventures, a venture capital firm in Boston. She's also a former partner at Fairhaven Capital Partners in Cambridge and an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School. And thank you to Anna.
And thank you for having me.
That's Anna Palmer. She's one of the founding partners at X Factor Ventures, a new fund that is investing in female-led startups. She's also co-founder and CEO of Wonder Mile and Fashion Project. Thanks again to you both. It'll be interesting also to see what happens with this new fund, X Factor Ventures, because there are some critics out there who wonder if a fund of this size can really change the entrenched culture in the industry. All right, folks, we're now going to turn to the first day of the CannaCon Expo. It's a 3-day event being held at the Heinz Convention Center. And this festival is for folks who are interested in learning more about the cannabis industry. Canacon's website invites people to come and make connections that will help them thrive in the marijuana business. Some Massachusetts voters have been eager to build those new business contacts, especially after voters passed Question 4 legalizing marijuana. But legislators are now debating changes to the law, including how high taxes will be and how much say local governments should have in zoning marijuana businesses. Legislators had given themselves a deadline of June 30th to present Governor Baker with a bill, but clearly they failed to meet that deadline. Now proposed changes have some marijuana advocates a little paranoid about how it might impair the sale of recreational marijuana, which is set to begin on July 1st next year. Joining us now is Chanel Lindsay. She's an entrepreneur and attorney who helped write Question 4. She's also going to be a panelist at the Canacon Expo. Hi, Chanel.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
I know. It feels like morning, doesn't it? So, Chanel, let's start with what's actually happening at the conference. Who's the intended audience?
Well, this conference is really for everyone. People who are already in the cannabis space that have businesses. So you'll see a lot of vendors there offering products and services, ways that people can start being involved in the medical and the adult use side.
Okay.
And then you also see a lot of consumers there as well. They're coming to check out the new products, to see what the different opportunities are for them to get involved in the industry. And then we have a segment that really is for entrepreneurs and investors, and that's our In Cannabis Tank.
And you're going to actually be on this three-person panel, is that right, where budding entrepreneurs can pitch ideas to investors, kind of like a Shark Tank, is
that right? Yeah, that's right. Okay. I'm going to be one of the so-called sharks, and we have some great companies coming in, some that are involved in renewable energy.
From around the Boston area?
Yeah, so Boston area. And then we have some renewables coming in from New York.
Okay.
We also have Bloom that's coming in, and they have a technology in the cannabis space. And we're really excited to be able to showcase really a broad spectrum of companies, those that actually are involved with the cultivation and touching the plant, and those on the ancillary side as well.
All right. You know, you just heard us actually listen to this segment, right, about women entrepreneurs and what it's like to be a woman in this space. I'm curious, you're one of the only women, is that right, sitting on this panel? Has it been difficult for women to enter the sort of entrepreneurial space in the marijuana industry?
Well, honestly, there are two different sides to that. On one side, you actually have many more female founders in the cannabis space than you would find in some other industries. Mm-hmm. Yet, we still face some of the same challenges that you would see, lack of access to capital, just generally the cannabis industry in prior to this has really been kind of seen as a male-dominated industry. Mm-hmm. The way that people who use cannabis are kind of portrayed is lacking
like
a little bit
yeah.
in the feminine side. But that really is an opportunity for people because, frankly, people of all ages and all genders use cannabis. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly a lot of people that are looking for products that more fit into their particular lifestyle. And you're starting to see many companies come into the space and offer those solutions.
All right. Is Canacon also reaching out to communities of color, communities that have somewhat been sort of disenfranchised, I would say, as this as the cannabis sector has sort of moved from being this thing that was criminalized into something that is now being legalized?
Well, that's a huge part of cannabis legalization that we need to be aware of. You know, the disparate impact and treatment under prohibition, the fact that the majority of people that are arrested and jailed for cannabis are people of color. And that's something we've been really intentional when in Massachusetts of trying to be inclusive, you know, as we're moving forward to protect people against felony prohibitions. And those are some of the things that hang in the balance with the legislative stance right now as we're waiting to see whether or not there are going to be changes to the law. And at this point, we really are encouraging people, you know, to call their state reps and to call the governor and their senators and really demand that the original law be implemented because we are past the deadline. It doesn't look like there's been much progress. And the Senate bill that came out really was in line with what the voters said. And I think that even Governor Baker at this point has started to imply that we should just be moving forward and implementing the initiative that the voters passed.
That the voters passed, yeah. So, Chanel, I do want to ask you, though, about the sort of hang-ups in the legislature, right? The Massachusetts legislature says that it's trying to essentially come up with this compromise between the House and the Senate version of bills that would make some changes to the law that was passed by voters. One of the biggest areas of contention has been taxes. Question 4 called for a 12% tax on marijuana products. The Senate wants to keep that in place, but the House has said it wants to increase that tax to 28%, which is essentially more than double what voters approved. Do you have a sense of how that increase in tax could affect the marijuana industry, particularly sort of the business side of it that we've been talking about?
Well, absolutely. It's a big problem to have taxes that would then prevent people from visiting a dispensary. If the cost is too high, it's going to be prohibitive, and you're going to allow the illicit market to still thrive. So the idea is to strike the balance between having enough tax revenue to have the benefit to our state coffers that we're looking for, to have money to go back to schools, to have money to go back to different programs, but you also want to make the product accessible and have people actually using those legal outlets. And that's why it was important, and it's important to keep that tax rate reasonable.
Got it. Okay. So I want to play a little bit of clip of tape that we have. The chairman of the Marijuana Policy Committee in the Massachusetts House, his name is Mark Cusack, has said that the 28% tax, in his mind, is reasonable, and it would be necessary to pay for the implementation of the new marijuana laws. Here he is introducing the bill that passed the House last month.
It's in no one's interest to implement and regulate this new marketplace on a shoestring budget, and that's what we avoid by ensuring that we capture the revenue necessary to implement this in the best way for the people of the Commonwealth.
So, Chanel, I mean, is he right? Do you get a sense that it is a drastic policy change and that in some ways you do sort of want to ensure that the state is able to sort of effectively enforce the new regulations in any way?
Well, the way that you do that is that you quickly implement and you get those stores up and running, and there'll be plenty of tax revenue coming in
from those sales.
Correct.
Got it. All right. Another point of contention has been just the amount of authority local governments should have over zoning marijuana businesses. What's your take on some of the concerns that people have had within sort of the advocacy industry that this could actually hurt the business of marijuana sales as well?
Well, we saw this happen on the medical side. So under the
zoning. Yeah.
Correct. On the medical program, the way that it works is that towns actually have to opt in to allowing medical dispensaries to come. And we've seen that this has been a big issue because there's a lot of this kind of not in my backyard that happens at the town level. And you have these kind of selectmen or city council or board zoning boards making these decisions. And on behalf of an entire town, a very small group of people. Mm-hmm. And so when we were drafting the adult use initiative, it was very important that we structured it that if a town didn't want to have, if they wanted to ban a cannabis establishment, that that would actually require a vote by the town, which seems very reasonable. It, you know, if the state and the people pass an initiative, then we should respect the will of that people unless that town has decided differently. And so, and again, it gives the town the option to opt out. But it allows everyone to have a voice in that. And that Senate bill kept that provision, but the House bill changed it essentially back to having to opt in or having a small group of people, selectmen, be in charge of that very important decision that would impact, you know, everyone in the community.
Got it. Chanel, we just have about 30 seconds left, and I wanted to ask you briefly about something that interests me, particularly after we heard this last segment about women and funding and the difficulties that they face, is that there's also been a concern about funding within the marijuana industry, but a somewhat different concern, right? Because of the legal status of marijuana nationally, there are some financial institutions who just aren't willing to work with marijuana businesses. So how are folks able to gain access to capital?
So banking is a huge issue. You find angel investors. It really is private capital at this point that you're leaning on, or interesting investment techniques, whether it's a loan or a royalty. So there are different ways that you can attract this capital. And you're starting to see banks are very, very interested. They're just concerned about being involved. And so, again, the need for additional advocacy, both on the state and the federal level, because we've really reached a point where this issue needs to be addressed for the entire industry, banking and merchant processing.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Chanel. Chanel Lindsay is an attorney and entrepreneur. She is going to be a panelist at the Conicon Expo that's happening at the Heinz Convention Center. Thanks again. And stay with us, listeners. There is more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid.
Winter is coming.
This Sunday, HBO's Game of Thrones returns. And if you haven't seen it yet, there is still time to binge. Do not worry. If my math is right, you could actually fully catch up in about 56 hours straight, although that probably would not be extraordinarily healthy. But if dragons and zombies are not your thing, there is still plenty of other great TV shows and movies to catch up on this summer. And joining us now to give us his take on what we should be binging on this summer is Ty Burr, film critic and cultural columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Ty.
Hi, Asma.
Thank you for coming, joining us, I should say. So, Ty, let's start with Game of Thrones. It is returning Sunday for the first half of its final season. I will say, isn't the big question always, you know, essentially who's going to live, who's going to die? More or less.
And whether this the big battle that we've been sort of waiting for God knows how many years is actually going to happen in this season, or whether we're going to have to wait for the next thing. You know, the events move so slowly in this world, but rather rivetingly.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular you're watching for this season?
Oh, you know, there are certain people I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss Hodor, you know. I'm not getting too attached to Littlefinger, Peter Baelish's character, because his time is just about up. I'm wondering if Sansa, what she's going to do with her spine now that she's finally grown one. I'm wondering what Cersei is going to do now that she's out of heirs, since the last one took a header in the end of the... I'm sorry, is that a spoiler?
I mean, no, so Ty, I've got to pause you there when you're talking about Littlefinger.
Please.
And all this. So, okay, I have to confess, I have not actually
seen the
Game of Thrones. I know, right? Like, our producers were just as shocked as you are. But Ken, for people who haven't seen it, could you explain why it's such a pop culture phenomenon? I mean, I recognize this. My sister was binging on it, you know, just last weekend to try to catch up.
You know, after a certain point, there is an up curve. There's a learning curve there. And you have to also get over the, you know, the HBO brutality. Hey, we're cable. The B stands for boobs and brutality. And once you get over that, you get sucked into the many chess pieces of the show and the characters that are all interestingly venal one way or another. There's very few people who are pure-hearted, and the ones that are don't tend to stick around very long. But there's a lot of divas, male and female. There's a lot of moving parts. And after a certain point, you've just invested so much time and emotion that at this point, you know, you just want to see. You're on the roller coaster and you can't get off.
I see.
So I would say, go online, do some flashcards, you know.
but it's worth watching, like if I'm a newcomer.
That would actually be a very curious lab experiment. Sit somebody down who has never seen the show and ask them to figure out what the hell is going on.
All right. So, Ty, since we've been talking about Game of Thrones, let's stick with TV for a little bit longer. Showtime has brought back Twin Peaks. That's the early 1990s cult favorite. It's this paranormal murder mystery with some horror mixed in there. What's it really about?
There is no easy question to that. You know, back 25 years ago, it was a cult TV series.
Yep,
now it's an even more of a cult TV series. Showtime built it up with a big, double premiere, and everybody tuned in to sort of the nostalgia fix.
Mm-hmm.
And it's David Lynch, ladies and gentlemen. This is the most effectively, successfully, genuinely, artistically surrealist creator in major commercial American entertainment of the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
He is going to mess with your head. So that first premiere kind of cleared the room, and all the people who just kind of want to, oh, where's the log lady? It was so weird that they're all gone.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of a coterie of us who are just riveted by the weirdness of it. And I don't care. I don't really know what's going on, and I don't care. But it is the energy of it is so particular and so deliriously delightful. You don't know what's going to happen, but the filmmaking, I mean, Lynch is kind of working on a plane of his own here, and it's not anything traditionally narrative, but if you're willing to go there, It's quite a ride, and so, I don't know where it's going, and nobody knows where it's going.
So, Ty, why did it get canceled by ABC back in the day, right? And now Showtime is bringing it back? Just, if it was such a popular, you know, cult favorite.
If you've seen the original two seasons, the first season was brilliant. The second season, halfway through, they solved the murder of Laura Palmer, mm-hmm. more or less. And then it kind of got wiggy and ran out of gas. And I get the sense that even Lynch lost interest in it. And so it was just sort of petered out. And now it is back, but he's using it almost as a career summation of all his various tendencies and interests and images. And it's a show that exudes more sort of palpable dread about life in America than, and more nightmarish, inexplicable dread, nothing you can actually articulate. He gets under the skin of things better than almost any other filmmaker working. Again, it's not for everybody, but it's quite a ride.
All right. So, Ty, I also know that there are some movies you've liked recently. Let's start with Okja. It's on Netflix. It's about a girl who's trying to keep a company essentially from abducting for her best friend, which happens to be this giant, really gentle beast. Scientists created the beast to help solve world hunger in the movie. Let's listen to this clip from Okja.
The world is running out of food, and we're not talking about it. We needed a miracle. And then we got one. Say hello to a super piglet.
So, Ty, that is actress Tilda Swinton, one of the stars of Okja. Without giving, I would say, too much away, can you tell us a little bit about the film and what struck you about it?
Well, it is about a girl and her giant mutant pig.
Yes.
It is from Korean director Bong Joon-ho, who is last seen in these parts with Snowpiercer, the movie about where the remnants of humanity are on a train that circumnavigates Earth. He does these parody parables. He is one of the most naturally gifted filmmakers out there. And this is sort of a Charlotte's Web updated to the near future with nightmarish aspects with part, you know.
I know, I saw the trailer. I was like, Charlotte's Web, that seems a little dark.
yeah. Well, it's the kind of movie that's probably going to make your kid a vegetarian for life if you show it to them. There are parts of it that are almost like a Miyazaki movie, absolutely delightful. And there are parts that are dark, 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 and very funny. He is a very funny but darkly funny filmmaker, and Tilda Swinton plays evil corporate twins. Jake Gyllenhaal gives what's probably the most outre performance of his career as a TV animal show host, gone renegade. It is a very odd film, but it's a very compelling film. And I don't know anybody who has seen it who hasn't been blown away by it. It's not showing in theaters because Netflix basically, Bong Joon-ho had a good experience streaming Snowpiercer and reaching a new audience, and he's gone that way with Netflix. And Netflix, of course, is trying to attract filmmakers. And this, you know, may be the future of a lot of film or a particular
TV,
kind
right?
of film is. Yeah. Not going to theaters. You can only see it on TV, and you should.
All right. Ty, another movie that's been getting some attention is The Big Sick. It's this romantic comedy starring Kumail Nanjiani. He's a Pakistani-American comedian who some folks may know from his role on the HBO series Silicon Valley. The film is based on a true story about Kumail's relationship with his now wife, Emily Gordon. We have some sound from that movie as well. Here's Kumail telling his friend, who's also Pakistani, about Emily for the first time.
I have to tell you something, babe. I've been dating this girl. She's white.
A white girl?
Hey, you can't look like you and yell white girl.
It's okay. We hate terrorists.
And so, Ty, we've just got a couple minutes left, but I do want you to talk about this. I mean, we know that early on in the courtship, Emily has this health issue that ends up sending her to the hospital, hence the name of the movie, The Big Sick. And Kumail is trying to navigate the tension between both his family and her family and friends. What do you like about this movie?
What I like about this movie, well, there's the politically correct reason why you like this movie. It is a movie about starring a Pakistani-American about an interracial relationship at a time when America needs to see movies with different kinds of people in the leads. But that is, you know, a nice reason to see the movie, a good reason, socially good reason, and a reason, I think part of the reason the movie is a success, though, and it actually is spreading to more and more theaters, is that it is a movie that makes you feel good. And you buy into this relationship. He's delightful. She's delightful. His parents are hilarious, and her parents, who turn up about halfway through the movie and are played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano. If you've never thought of those two people together, it shouldn't mix. They are so hilarious together. You kind of want them to be your parents for at least a week. The scenes with Nanjiani and the parents are absolutely delightful. It's a movie that I don't want to give too much away, but it is, you know, there aren't too many experiences we have now where we just come out and we feel good. This is one of those in many, many ways. I'm recommending it to a lot of people, especially those who say, there's nothing for me in the movie theaters. This is a movie for you.
It's a feel-good movie, you would say.
Yes, I guess that's what the critics say. It's a feel-good
movie. I just want to ask you also real quick. So what did you think about the idea that it's based on this true story? Did that strike you? Because the whole time you're watching it, you know that this actually happened.
Well, no, now that you've spoiled it,
I know.
You actually don't know that until the end credits.
Where
you see the photos of the actual people involved. That's an interesting question. Here's what, he based it closely on what really happened. Does that always make the best movie? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I would argue in this case, yes. That works, but there's sometimes
he's playing himself. That's kind of cool.
He's playing a version, and his character is named himself, after himself. But where it's in the genre of stand-up comics making movies about being a stand-up comedian, so it fits.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Ty.
Thank you, Asma.
All right, folks, that is all we have time for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston.